with the idea of the names Adam and Paul, calling the film Adam and Paul, but never allowing the audience to figure out which one is called Adam and which one is called Paul, there was something about that idea that I wanted to show, like, we do step over these people. We call them the junkies, and we leave them nameless. And I think that we need, leaving an audience struggling to find out which one is which felt like a success to me. That's what I thought the ultimate success of the film would be, that they're struggling to name people.
Welcome to the Social Fabric podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Splendori, and this week my guest is Mark O'Halloran. Mark is an award-winning scriptwriter and actor, with a large body of work that includes Adam and Paul, Garage, Viva, and many more. This conversation moves from growing up in Ennis to his love for Cuba, the upcoming projects of film adaptations and new screenplays, and lots more. You can find more episodes on socialfabric.ie, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Only a few seconds of the music choice is played in the podcast for rights reason. You can find all the songs on Social Fabric playlist on Spotify. The program is also broadcast weekly on Dublin's Near FM 90.3. Please share, download and review. It's the only way independent podcasts like this have a chance to survive. And if you want to get in touch with the program, please email me at info@socialfabric.ie. The theme tune is Alice by Lucky Bones.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days, and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while. Been so long now.
I know. But look, we're going to start because I don't want to keep you too long. But I guess I'm here with Mark O'Halloran. Just want to say I'm here with Mark. I'm not here with Mark. We're far away from one another, social distancing. But I guess we might as well start from the coronavirus, Mark, because it's such a life-changing thing for us all. And tell me about how is it treating you, and tell me a bit about your experiences so far.
Well, I think along with lots of people, because I live alone, etc., there is the loneliness aspect of it. You're sitting at home, you have all the social media interactions, but you miss people, you know, you miss kind of being able to touch people and hug people and shake their hands and embrace them, and that's gone. So, but you just got to get used to that. That's the way it's going to be for a while. Stay in touch with people through social media and all of that is good, though social media would drive you mental at the moment because everybody's a virologist.
Who knew
there were so many immunologists and virologists in the world? So there's a bit of that going on, but there is, you know, I'm lucky in that my mother is living up in Sligo now, has gone to live with, is in rural Sligo with my sister and her wife, and that's safe for her, so that makes me happy. And just, you know, we're just worrying for the world is all, you know, it's something that nobody really could have seen coming, and I don't think we're programmed to see these things coming anyway, and it came so quickly. Like, life has been turned on its head so quickly. Like, I look back at photographs, you know, I did this public interview with Charlie Kaufman at the very start of this month in a theater with 400, 500, 600 people. And I was hugging people going out the door and everything. Like, when I think about that now, it's so weird. Like, even I'd be watching films at home and I see people hugging each other or being on a packed metro and I'm like, get out, it's all terrible. Our view of the world has changed so quickly.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. The same, we were watching some series, I can't remember, but Boardwalk Empire a couple of nights ago. And I was like, no, you can't shake hands. In my head, I was like, you can't go near and shake hands. But what is that doing to, like, do you think, like, even yesterday I had to go into a shop and there was a social distancing strips on the ground, which I thought was fantastic. Everything was very civil. You know, we walked in, myself and my son walked in, we kept distance. And in my head, I was thinking, is that what's going to be after all of this is over for a while?
I think that this is going to sit in our subconscious anyway for a long time. And the idea, you know, whether it will hurt our ability to connect with other people, I don't know. I mean, I love to think about that in, you know, 3 or 4 months' time, we have this massive national celebration of victory over coronavirus, like the VE Day or something like that, where everybody's out on the streets kissing strangers and dancing with their neighbors and all of that. And that's kind of a lovely thought I have in my head. And maybe a massive blowout will clear us all, you know.
Well, I have an optimistic view of it. I'm thinking that for the little things I've seen the last couple of weeks, in Ireland specifically, I'm obviously from Italy, and I was talking to my sister yesterday, and there's a different ball game in Rome.
Yeah.
I had to bring the army out to stop people congregating. It's just crazy. But there's some lovely stuff happening at the moment with society. Are you optimistic about what we're going to see in the near future when all of this is over?
Well, I think to date, Irish society has dealt with it very well. We're very compliant in things like social distancing. We have a genuine, you know, respect for older people, I think, in our culture. I mean, maybe it's been changing lately, but people really want to keep people safe. We also don't, you know, I look at what's happening in the UK and this, you know, the news that was out today that it was Dominic Cummings who okayed the herd immunity, which is really just one of those, I'm the smartest guy in the room, let's go for the radical plan. And I'm like, don't go for the radical plan. This is not time for the radical plan. Let's all just stay at home for a while. And I think there's been a sort of sensible so far, you know, there's a lot of things to get right here about making sure that the health service is working and keeping health service workers and frontline staff safe and all that. But I do also think my neighbors look out for each other. You know, we pass each other on the street and we pledge to if any of us need help to do that. You know, if you look at some of the initiatives that have gone on online, Helen O'Reilly did this thing where she's set up this whole network really quickly of helpers who are willing in every town in Ireland who are willing to help and deliver groceries and look out for their elderly. And then I saw there's things that make me feel a little bit sad and hopeful at the same time. I saw a picture of this man showing his new grandchild to his father, who was inside a window, and he was looking out at his son holding his new baby, and they weren't able to, and it broke my heart to look at it. And yet I felt like they love each other and they're going to keep each other safe. But there's something terribly sad about it at the same time. I mean, I just hope that the conditions in Italy improve for them. I've got, you know, lots of Italian friends, and I talk every day to a couple that I know in Rome about what their life is like there and their own fears. And I hope that people in America, my brother lives in Boston, and I worry for him. Their health service seems to be about to be hit by a real wave of stuff. And then I have a partner who lives in Cuba, and I worry about the Cubans. You know, they don't have the most vast of resources. They have a genuine community-based health service. That's the only thing that I can say will help them. And they can also sort of get they can get their society to move very quickly. So hopefully by the summertime, we'll have maybe a calmer world and it'll be better.
Let's hope so. And as I said to you, Mark, I always break it up with a couple of songs. I was asking you to pick a few songs. And just give us your first song and then and tell me why you picked it.
Well, this is a song by the band The Fall. I don't know whether not, you know, they don't have a huge, huge fan base, but I've always liked them because Marky Smith was always irascible and mad and blah blah blah. But the end of this month I hit 50, and they have this song
welcome
on this album.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd reach 50. Like, I remember the day my father reached 50, and he was sitting in his chair in our house looking very depressed, and I remember just sitting looking at him going, "You are fucking ancient. You are absolutely the oldest man I've ever seen in my whole life." And now I reach 50, and I never thought I'd reach 50. I never thought I would be a 50-year-old man. But anyway, on this album by The Fall called Imperial Wax Album, they've got this song called 50-Year-Old Man. It's a 13-minute rockabilly song in which the chorus is, "I'm a 50-year-old man, what you going to do about it?" I promised myself on the morning of my birthday, I'm going to get up, brew some strong coffee, put on "I'm a 50-year-old man, what you going to do about it?"
was just reading yesterday's Irish Times. Hugh Lennon had a nice piece about in the culture section about how the virus is impacting the cultural landscape in Ireland, obviously. Well, yeah. Worldwide, but in Ireland specifically. What's it like for you? Like, I have a business which is kind of ground to a halt at the moment, like every other business, and it's commercial, but it's, you know, it's an everyday trading, buying, selling, building business. But for you guys, artists, what's it like? What's it looking like? You know, tell me a bit about your fears or what's going on.
Well, there's the immediate impact, which is all theatres, all cinemas, all gigs and performances have closed down. All film sets have closed down, all TV productions. So like basically the entire arts community is now unemployed. Now for writers and all of that, there is the thought that, you know, you might have a couple of commissions that are still live, you can work on them. I do think we've got to reimagine the world though. And that's a job of work that's going to take some time. The impact of this, you know, there can't ever be a drama set in 2020 that doesn't have this at the heart of it.
Mm. That's true.
And if you're writing something that's in 2019, knowing that this is coming down the path at the group of people that you're writing about, you know that that's got to influence the story in some way. And do we need to start writing immediately about the situation that we're in? What social isolation means for people? What duties and cares and duties of care we have to each other? Do we need to start writing about that now? So I think a lot of writers are sitting at home waiting to start because they don't know where to start. Mm. But I think they will start pretty soon, and hopefully we'll find new means of communicating those ideas, those thoughts, those stories, those music. I mean, you see lots of things like even something as simple as the co-video party that's going on every night where people watch a movie together and they comment on it. Or there's some people who do this video or the film challenge where they reenact scenes from films in their own homes and they post them online. I think all of that is really interesting. I think we'll start. I think the Abbey has this new initiative where they've commissioned 50 writers to write 50 monologues that will be performed and delivered pretty much early in April. Each of them will be a short monologue, about 5 minutes long, I think. And it's performed by one actor in a room. It'll be filmed and it'll be streamed online, which I think is a really interesting an interesting idea of how we're going to have to communicate stories from now on. So I think all of that is interesting. But also then on a personal level and on a private level, every artist is a person, you know, and the fear that this engenders, it has a way of closing down your creative process in a way. And that's kind of frightening also, you know. Sometimes you just can't keep on keeping on, for want of a better word. You've got to regroup yourself or something.
I genuinely believe art is really, really important to society. They've done studies in England where they introduced, I think Hull was one of the places where they introduced art in all different forms, and the whole community got better for it. You know, there was less crime. And so it's extremely important. I know it's a hard one to talk about at the moment when there's so much going on, but it is something we need, you know.
We do need those songs. We do need those stories. I mean, you see, if the only way we can interpret the world is by retelling it to each other, which is pretty much it, the only way we can make sense of the world is to transform it into stories and share it. Mm. Then if we have a whole new world, we have to start interpreting it very quickly and start sharing it. What's difficult about this situation is, how do you communicate those stories? How do you stage them? How do you, you know, the theaters are closed. The cinemas are closed. So we have to find a way of platforming those stories. But I think that will happen very quickly.
Okay. Well, that's encouraging too, because again, Hugh Lennon was saying, and you know, what was interesting out of this, the last couple of weeks, is the creativity. I think it was John Boyne created a short story competition for teenagers.
Yes.
And, you know, there's lovely stuff coming out, but it's obviously a temporary. Eventually, you know, you guys need to make a living out of what you create. And it's always, I suppose, as an artist, you're always leave from one acting to another, to another story, to and it's
for sure. Yeah. For sure. I mean, I think nobody can tell what's going to happen. Nobody can tell what the economic model is going to be when we leave this situation, because we will be largely, I imagine, for probably the bones of a generation or of 10 years, we're going to be a largely socialized society where we own everything. You own everything. that the government, you know, we will be a government centralized, almost socialist society, because we have to socialize everything that's going on. And so I think that'll be interesting to see how the arts fits into that kind of a scenario, how we prioritize the arts in that new world will be interesting.
Okay. Give me your second song, please, Mark.
Okay, my second song is, I think this one is kind of an obvious choice, but and it's kind of a little bit spooky, but it's Ghost Town by The Specials. I was walking around my environment the other day humming it to myself. I mean, it came out of a time in Britain, and I remember it being around, you know, I was around at that time. And it was dealing with the desolation that the Thatcher government had inflicted on communities. And but I also think it's just a cracking tune.
I did a bit of research, obviously. I listened to a couple of interviews with the Asian and a few things. But what I'm interested in, I was interested a little bit about the background. In one of the interviews, you said that you ran away from Ennis when you were 17. It's funny because now that you mention your age, at that stage, I was in Ennis for my very first trip to Ireland. And that was one of the catalysts for me moved to Ireland. I went to Ennis on an Interrail trip, and I stayed there for a few days and absolutely loved it. And and I'm a couple of years older than you, so I was about around that time. As you were leaving, I was coming in.
I was hanging around there. We could have missed each other.
And why did you run away from Ennis? Tell me a bit about your story.
Well, I'd finished school, and so it was time for me to move on anyway. But also, I never had any plans to hang around in Ennis. Okay. Like, it's a weird one. I look at Ennis now and I know that it formed me, and I'm really interested in thinking of those stories again, and I've been writing something about Ennis at that time. But, you know, I was a young gay kid. There really wasn't room for you at that point. Now, there is now, and it's a really progressive town and it's done really well, and my family were always good with it and all of that, but really, I wanted the city. I wanted 24-hour shops and gay discos. That was pretty much it.
And the city being Dublin or Galway?
Yeah, I mean, I have over time, like, I've lived in the Netherlands, for instance. I lived in Amsterdam for a year, and I've lived at times in London, spent some time in New York and la la la. But Dublin has always been somewhere that I absolutely adore. Like, I still love it. It's the size of it is really easy for me to handle. It's big enough and small enough at the same time. And I think that there is that idea of community spirit is still there. There's a great sense of humor, and I love the use of language in this city. I love the way that people speak on the street. And I was always, you know, when I came here, when I was that young, I thought it was the center of the world. Like, I thought it was just extraordinary. And of course it isn't, but it's the center of my world, so that's okay.
And that's interesting when you say there wasn't room for a 17-year-old gay man in Ennis. I mean, what was your support like, apart from your family, being a gay?
Well, I had friends. I had a friend, especially a very close friend, who I told and all of that. But really, you know, there was no positive place for you. There was no, you couldn't really be and hope for a normalized life. You were always going to be the outsider. And I thought, if I'm going to be the outsider, I'm going to be the outsider properly, you know? I'm not going to be an apologetic outsider. I'd rather go to Dublin and hang around with the queers who were doing their thing at the time, you know? And so I, that's, I kind of always knew that was coming down the line, you know. I always knew that that was, I would have to move. That's not a unique experience for a gay person, you know.
No. And I mean, even Dublin at that stage, because that's, I moved to Ireland in 91. And I do, you know, coming from Rome, I do remember being, backward is the wrong word, but.
Sure, no, it was though. Like, it was very conservative still.
Yeah.
There was a gay scene. It was very underground. I remember one of the early Pride marches that happened in the very early 90s. Like, we walked down O'Connell Street and we stopped just in front of the Central Bank, and there weren't enough people to stop the traffic on Dame Street. It was something like 200 people, and it was nerve-wracking because you were walking down the main street in Dublin, and there was people who were antagonistic. And I mean, that situation changed so quickly. You know, when you think about that, the Pride March now is like 60,000 people. Of course, it won't be this year, but like, it's a big party. But at the time, no, it wasn't. But then I met amazing people then. I remember when I first went out on the gay scene, I think I was part of a generation which kind of, you know, of both men and women, gay and straight, who just had enough. And they said, fuck you, to everybody. And that's how society changed. It was just like, no, actually, we're not going to, you know, the gay community that was there had just come out of, or was just in the middle of the AIDS trauma, and there was people dying, and yet, you know, there was still controversy over whether you could buy condoms, you know. There was a whole generation at that point who went, actually, fuck you. You're not going to do this to us. Yeah. And I really enjoyed being part of that. But then there was also bits in the gay community that I found funny. Like, I'd meet people and I'd be introduced to a guy and he'd be here, my name is Sean, and blah, blah. And then you'd meet him on the street in kind of normal life. And you'd go, hi, Sean. He goes, actually, my name isn't Sean, it's Brian. But I use Sean when I'm on the gay scene. And I kind of really enjoyed that. The malleability of personality that could go with that. And I thought that was fun, you know. I mean, obviously it came from not a great place, but
no.
But it was also kind of interesting. But I also remembered then the transformations that happened very quickly. The decriminalization happened in 92, 93. The George expanded and it had a big front window for the first time. Normally windows were blacked out, and or they were secret places. You went up back stairs or blah, blah, blah. And suddenly there was a very large window looking out onto the street, and there was a front door onto the street, and it wasn't, suddenly there was, people stopped apologizing. And I thought that was really interesting to live through.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very curious about, though, like 17, you're quite young, and to Dublin. What was it like? Where did you go? I mean, did you just...
Well, I didn't move immediately to Dublin. Okay. I moved to Galway for a while, and then I moved to Amsterdam, and I lived in Amsterdam for a year, and then I came back. And so by the time I got to Dublin, I was about 20.
Okay.
19 or 20, yeah.
Okay. Very good. Let's break it with another song then. What have you got next, please?
This kind of ties in with the whole sexuality thing in a weird sort of way. This is Once in a Lifetime by Talking Heads. And I remember I was 11 or 12 years when this, 11, I think, when this came on the television. And him saying, this is not my beautiful house, this is not my beautiful wife. I found the whole song to be so disturbing. And I kind of knew that it tied into that I wasn't going to fit in. Whatever was going on in my head, I was like, oh my God, he knows. The world is going to be a little bit strange. And so, and I love that song. To this day, I love that song. I think it's an amazingly complex vision of what it is to become an adult.
And you may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. And you may find yourself in another part of the world. And you may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. And you may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
Letting the days go by, let the water hold me down.
Everybody sees that. I love that song, but I've never seen it, obviously. The way you saw it, for me, was just getting at it. Getting out of the house, just going somewhere, become somebody else.
But it was the reason that someone would step out of their life. Like, this is not my beautiful house. This is not my beautiful wife. But this person is so dislocated from themselves that they'll walk away from themselves. I found that to be interesting.
Brilliant. Okay, so then you're in Dublin. Then where's the bug for acting? Because that's where you started, right? You started in theatre.
Yeah, I mean, that was always there. I always wanted to be an actor, and I went to I went away to Amsterdam to live there for a year, and I worked in a steel mill. That is the funniest thing ever. But anyway,
tell me about it.
I worked in this.
What is a steel mill?
A steel mill obviously makes steel for industry, and it was this place called Hog Ovens, which translates as huge ovens. And it's the largest steel mill in Western Europe, and it's near the seaside outside of Amsterdam. And it's this unbelievably grim landscape. It's acres and acres of these large tower things with flame coming out of the top of them, and people in, like, it was just the worst landscape ever. And but it was kind of funny living there. I mean, I found Amsterdam to be just an incredibly liberating place to live anyway, but I saved up money while I was there, and I went back and I auditioned for the Gaiety School of Acting, and I went there to train. So that was in 1991, maybe 1990, 91, and from there then I started what was a very, very slow career. I got little bits here and there. I got a part where I had three lines in this play that toured throughout the UK and then went into the West End for I don't know, 6 months. So I was being paid straight out of drama school, but I literally had three lines and I was understudying somebody. And the person I was understudying was Tom Jordan Murphy, who I ended up making Adam and Paul with. And also there were amazing actors in it. There was people like Niall Buggy and Anita Reeves. It was June on the Paycock. Anita Reeves was playing Juno, which was amazing. Mark Lambert was in it. These people that I, you know, and I used to sit backstage every evening and literally just watch these great actors working. And it was an amazing thing for me. And then after that, I came home. And again, things were really slow, slowly, slowly. My career has always been slow and unexpected, you know.
Mm. But your career now, it's, you've been at it for a few years and you've quite a body of work, between the acting and writing, and you're still doing both, right? You're still writing.
Yeah, I'm still doing both. I mean, writing, weirdly, my acting career is really unpredictable for me. Literally, I never know whether I'm going to get work or not get work. And it's going through a dry patch, I would say, at the moment. Occasionally I have bits of work that I'm really proud of, like something like Adam and Paul, I'm incredibly proud of. Mm. But it didn't really translate into a massive career on television or film afterwards. So you just kind of go, well, I've got this great thing. Anyway, and then I did The Virtues last year, which was the Shane Meadows thing. And again, I thought, oh God, this is a good piece of work. But it didn't translate into anything. So like I'm lucky, I get these jobs once in a while, and I'm really lucky that I have them, and I really enjoy doing them. But it's not been a self-generating acting career for some reason. Writing-wise, it's much easier for me. I can pick and choose the writing gigs that I want to do. Writing, I find, is a little bit more difficult for me, though. Like, I think I said it a few times before, which is like, any kind of writing job that I have sort of manifests itself as a crisis.
Mm.
A crisis of, I can't do this, or a crisis of, like, I have to understand something. I have to go in and start writing about it. And so it's not... You know, I often listen to people who talk about how much they love writing and they love getting to their desk every day. Packs of wild horses have to drag me into my office and sit me down and slap me around the head before I'll do anything. And that is kind of a sickening feeling at times. And then I do get a satisfaction when it's done, not when I'm doing it. And so my writing can be slow sometimes, but I'm really proud of the things I have done. You know, I've done some things that I go, okay, well, that's going to last, you know.
Absolutely. But just, I want to stay with the acting for a second. I know you've done a lot of stuff, and not necessarily from an actor's point of view. Obviously, you're expecting to be a little, you know, blossom a little bit more as such.
But yeah.
You've done so many different characters. You're not typecast as such. You're not the Irish guy shows up, and you know, you've done the English policeman. You've done the. I've watched some of the really interesting movie, actually, that esoteric, I suppose, History's Future.
History's Future, yeah.
And that's completely different from other stuff you've done from Adam and Paul. And so I'm just curious, why then you think you're not, why is this your career? Why are people knocking on the door going, look, I know you can do 10 different things. Why don't you come and work with us?
I'm not sure. I don't think I fit into everything very easily. You know, you'd never cast me as a romantic lead, for instance, nor would I really have any interest in it. Okay. Or you couldn't cast me as being hunky action hero. That's not going to happen. But sometimes if you want somebody who's going through distress, I'm your man. I'm your man. If you're going through emotional distress, I'm there for you. And that film was really interesting film. It was this... actually, she's a well-known artist called Fiona Tan, who, you know, does a lot of gallery-based video work, and she does found photo projects, and, you know, she represented the Netherlands at the Biennale, and she's, you know, she's shown at MoMA and the Roxy. Is the Roxy in Rome? Modern Art Gallery, I think it is. Yeah, and. And at the Pompidou Center and all that. And that film was made all over Europe. Like, we made it in Paris. It was made in Greece, Spain, Germany, Ireland, London. And it was about a man who had been beaten on the street and who had lost his entire memory and his sense of who he was. And so he wanders through Europe basically trying to find himself. And he shifts. From one, every time he encounters somebody else, he's somebody different. So I really enjoyed doing that. And I got to work, I mean, it's kind of hilarious when I think about it. What is his name? The French actor. Denis Levant.
Okay.
Who's in things like Holy Motors. And he does this... If you ever see this, there's an ad that was only shown for about twice because it's so out there. I think it might have been made by Jonathan Glazer for The Flake. And he plays this demon going down a set of steps in a Baroque wig. He's just the most amazing physical actor. And I absolutely loved him. He was in that film, Les Amants de Pont-Neuf, which was around, you know, late 80s. Mm-hmm. He's absolutely brilliant. But she told me, Fiona, when she cast me in this, she said, look, we've got... a very large scene sequence with Denis Levant. So I was like, okay, cool. And then she said, you know, it's in French. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I can't speak French. And she goes, no, yeah, I know. We're probably going to shoot it in English. But I was going, yeah, cool. And as we got closer, she said, you know, well, actually, Denis Levant doesn't speak French, so you're going to have to do it in French. And like, I did school French. And I had to learn an 11-page duologue with Denis Levant in French. That we shot in one scene, in one take. So I love those kind of adventures. And for me, like, taking on a gig like that is an adventure. It's the equivalent of running away to sea in sort of ways. You end up doing these mad things. We filmed that in the middle of a banlieue or whatever they call them in on the outskirts of Paris. Denis Levant and me in French.
Well, you fooled me. I have school French as well, and I watched a scene with the girl, I forget her name now, you and her, and she thinks she recognizes you, and you blabber on in French and sounded good to me.
Yeah. It's that she also is quite a famous French actress, and yeah, it was interesting. I mean, I literally learned it by rote, and French pronunciation is very difficult. They've got all the which I don't hear properly.
Excellent. Okay, tell me about song number four, please, Mark.
Song number four. Let me look at my list. This is one by The Breeders, and it's called Off You. And I loved The Breeders' first album, Pod, was a really important album for me. And it came along, there was a whole bunch of albums at that time, especially something like Blue Lines by Massive Attack and The Breeders' Pod, which were really important. I had this Walkman, I used to listen to them, I used to walk around, and I know every inch of those albums. Now, this song isn't off that album, it's from a later album, and it's actually really soft, gentle tune, but I really love it, and I got to see them live last year, and Kim Deal is just the business. I love her.
I lay the silent sun, a thousand silence chills and shout. Cover me.
I see there in your background you have the poster of Adam and Paul, and I think, am I correct, it's 15 years since came out, or thereabouts? Because I know there was
easily it might be its 16th year. I think it premiered probably. Let me think. It probably premiered in the summer. It premiered in Galway in the summer of 2004, something like that. So it's 16 years.
16 years. No, because I remember they were going to do a special screening last year. I don't know if it happened here in Greystones in the Whale Theatre, but I don't think it happened.
There was some kind of. I remember it being about to happen and then didn't happen for some strange reason.
But what I'm interested in is the writing of that, and I know you spoke a lot about it, and there's plenty of podcasts and interviews with it. But what I'm really interested in more is that almost neorealism, you know, what I grew up with in Italy with the Pasolini, which is the cover of my podcast, is Pier Paolo Pasolini. It's stuff I grew up with at the time. That was it. That was the cinema I was watching. It was just real life put on a screen. But that's effectively what Adam and Paul was, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a kind of an interesting mix of that, you know. Pasolini, especially for me, if you look at the Gospel of St. Matthew, it's not actually naturalism at all. He works within, but there's something about the simplicity with which he delivers scenes. People stand there and they deliver what they need to say, and you cut to these beautiful faces, are these beautifully perfect faces of people he's found on the street and la la la. But it's very composed. And it's not kind of the De Sica thing. It's not the Bicycle Thieves where it's, you know, he's more studied than that. But for me, the touchstones for Adam and Paul were Laurel and Hardy, for sure. And then something like Pasolini, or also Bruno Demont, the French guy. But then there was also American films like Midnight Cowboy, which, like, for me were in my mind very heavily when I was writing it, because it's one of the most beautiful films. And when I went out with Tom Jordan Murphy for about 8 years, and one of our first Christmases together, I bought him a video cassette of Midnight Cowboy, because I said he should play Razzo Rizzo at some point. And funny enough, I wrote him the part of Razzo Rizzo, which is what he plays in Adam and Paul, you know. And so there was all those things mashing around. And then I met Lenny, and Lenny is really stylistically adventurous, and he's got this great purity to him, and he's got this idea of, you know, he shoots very complex things in a very simple way. He goes directly to what is at the center of an idea. And he kind of egged me on to write it as purely as I wanted to, you know. And not to think about all the kind of three-act structure-y kind of nonsense that goes on.
Well, I guess what I wanted to get with a question is, I know you say, you know, they need to drag you into the office to write something, but you're obviously good at it, and it's something you enjoy doing once you get it done, once you finish it. But when you sit down to, you know, your ideas come through, you decide, okay, that could make a movie. What do you try... Like, it's setting aside the commercial aspect of it. What do you want to achieve? Like, that story was quite powerful. Yes, you know, it was a comedy in it. You know, there was, but you tackled it. And the same, I think, with Viva, you tackled a particular aspect of our life that you wanted to highlight. Is that the idea? Like, is your next one?
When I was kind of came of age in Ireland, the Irish film industry was coming into a new phase. And one of the things that had always happened was that Americans came here and they filmed us as some sort of exotic creatures, and so things, or else we made our own films that were all about nationalism and how terrible the Brits had been to us and how we had suffered because of our nationalism. Even if we put sexuality on screen, it was sexuality seen through a prism of nationalism. If you look at the films of Neil Jordan or that, there's all that sort of thing going on. Whereas I was looking out my window at Parnell Street, and I was seeing loads of boys and girls who were heroin addicts wandering around in slow motion, talking almost like babies on the street, fighting over chalk ices, falling down on the street. And I thought, well, why doesn't somebody make a film about that? And I used to keep diaries of things that I saw of events that I saw on the street of young heroin addicts and what they were experiencing on the street, and that became the basis of what it was. There was a simplicity, and then at the same time, I was really into Laurel and Hardy and how simple they were. And one of the things that Len said to me when I delivered some scenes to him, I was saying like, well, we have to do lots of background where we go like, oh, we'll show how they didn't get on with their dad, or they'll meet their father, or they'll meet their mother, or blah, blah. And I said, you know, because people are going to want to know, how did they end up like this? And I remember Len saying to me, you know, nobody ever asks why Laurel and Hardy ended up being homeless. And I thought, oh yeah, that's true, actually. What you do is you set out the very simplicity of their lives, and we can get it. And we can make up our own minds about them and about where they're at. So that was kind of where it came from. And I was really proud of it. I felt that all of the laneways that it was shot in, I'd walk those laneways. I'd take shortcuts into town and I'd see boys down those laneways, or I'd see, you know, boys falling over in the main street of O'Connell Street. And I felt that people were stepping over them or trying to forget them or ignoring them. And with the idea of the names Adam and Paul, calling the film Adam and Paul, but never allowing the audience to figure out which one is called Adam and which one is called Paul, there was something about that idea that I wanted to show, like, we do step over these people. We call them the junkies, and we leave them nameless. And I think that we need, leaving an audience struggling to find out which one is which felt like a success to me. That's what I thought the ultimate success of the film would be, that they're struggling to name people.
Okay. Yeah, so that's interesting. When I spoke to people from for this podcast, from Anna Leafy, both the director and the head of services, that's the very first thing they said. This was last year. They said is the invisibility of homeless people with addiction that contributes to serious mental health issues for them.
For sure.
Ignored, not even looked at, and that's powerful. Okay, so tell me about your song number five.
Song number five, I think we'll go for something Latin, something from Cuba. There's a singer called Celia Cruz, and she's got this song called Toro Mata. It's full of life and full of exuberance, and it kind of ties in with my time in Cuba and what Cuba has meant to me in my life. And especially the music is just, you know, salsa music is gorgeous and it's full of sunshine. And, you know, my time in Cuba has been a major part of my life now.
Y dice, toro mata y toro mata, toro mata, rumba un vero y toro mata, toro, toro, y torito,
toro mata y toro mata, toro mata y rumba un vero y toro mata.
Apolo no le permite hacer el quite a pichincha y toro mata, toro, toro y torito. Apolo no, no le permite.
That's fabulous. We're obviously in some sort of synchronicity, because my next question is exactly that. It's Cuba, because apart from, again, I read you had to do a lot of studying about Cuba to write Viva, to, you know, to get to understand the culture and the music and so on and so forth. If I'm correct, you spent a bit of time there recently. You just told me your partner lives there. So
yeah,
I was just in Miami a couple of weeks ago before this crazy stuff happened, and didn't think much of Miami, but I loved the Cuban influence. And I went to Little Havana, there's Calle Ocho in the middle of the city. And I know very little about Cuba. So tell me about your experience with Cuba. Why is such an important part of your life, and what you experienced there?
Well, I went there first, it would have been nearly 14 years ago. And at the time, I just remember arriving there and it being like, Havana can be so overwhelming. Mm. It can be teeming with life. And it feels, when you first get there, to be sort of more dangerous than it is. Actually, it's a really safe place. It's always been a very safe city to walk around and all that. But I then began to kind of investigate, and I thought that this was going to be, you know, this other society that I'd never encountered, blah, blah, blah. But they began to remind me a lot of Irish people. And in weird ways, I think the Irish are probably the Cubans of the North Atlantic. you know, there's a historical connection between the two in that, first of all, there was a connection between Irish people and the slave trade that went on.
Mm-hmm.
But also, the way we deal with our nationalism, troubles with our next door neighbours, the way we define ourselves as being not our next door neighbours, and our relationship to our nationalism as well, in which that, like, I remember from my youth growing up being incredibly proud of being Irish and really mortified by it at the same time. The kind of like, yeah, Ireland, we're shit like nobody else. Or we're an embarrassment to each other, but at least we're here. And they have that very same thing. They've got that really complicated connection to their nationalism. They are so delighted that they stood up to the United States, and they're so mortified by the failures of their society at the moment, or their perceived failures of their economic model. And they're all desperate to leave, and they're all desperate to not lose their Cubanism. And then they're also cultural people, they're literary people, they're music people, and they enjoy drinking and dancing and having fun. They're a well-educated population. And I think there's a phrase that I use for both them and Irish people, which is that we're damaged jokers. That we front up with this kind of the crack. And underneath there are cracks, actually. And I kind of like that about them. I've really felt at home there. And indeed, as this crisis has deepened here, the one thing I've longed for is to be in Havana and to see how everything is there. And I do hope that they stay safe, you know.
And your partner there, so it's a long-distance relationship.
Yeah, it's been difficult. I tried to spend as much time as possible over there. We met when I was making the film Viva over there, and we found it impossible to get visas. We've been turned down for visas for him to come here. So, and it's very difficult for Irish, for Cuban people to come to Ireland. So, we'll continue on. It's great when I'm over there. That's all I can say. And we hang out, and he's a fun person.
Oh, that's great. No, it's I remember seeing it, and we'll get to Twitter in a second, but I'll get to see, I remember seeing a lot of the great photographs on Twitter. You're just posting, just a shot of some amazing main street. So would you move there if you had a child, if you get a visa, would you move there for a couple of years and work there?
I don't think you could move there as a foreigner. They very rarely allow that to happen. You can go there for up to 3 months, and then you can leave and come back again up to something like 6 months. It's quite complicated. And I think the way that work is structured for me, probably not. Mm-hmm. But I go there for, like, the last time I was there for just over 2 months. And that was great. I studied. I went in and studied Spanish at the University of Havana.
Wow,
and that was a really lovely time, getting up to study every day and then just living a normal life there, which was kind of fun. I mean, life there can be also very frustrating. Like, I remember, some of the first times we'd be settling at home, and my fella likes to cook, and he'd go, "I'll cook. You go out and buy stuff." And I go, "Okay, cool. What do we need?" Well, get some eggs. And I said, "Well, which shop do you buy eggs in?" And he goes, "You don't buy eggs in a shop." And I was like, "Well, what do you do?" He goes, "You go for a walk, and if there are eggs, there'll be eggs."
Oh, wow. So
basically, you go for a walk and you find somebody selling eggs on the side of the street, and you have to go for long wanders and see whether anybody has eggs or not eggs, and if not, they're not there. So you go and buy, I don't know, a big lump of cheese, and there's all that kind of frustration. Shopping can take a long time there because some shops are empty and some shops are not, and you have to go from one to the other. And
but is that not then better for the community? Are the people know each other better there, or it's just?
Oh, I mean, like, everything is. Everybody knows everybody there, and literally there's a lot of talk on the street. There's a lot of people sitting around, and even the way they use the internet there, because they've got very little bandwidth, so you do not have private Wi-Fi in houses. It just doesn't happen. So what there are is, throughout the city, there are hotspots. So you have to go out with your laptop and sit in a park and do your internet there. So you see people sitting on park benches talking with their family in Miami, for instance, or thereabouts. And then their next door neighbor will pass by and they'll go, hey, say hello to Pedro in Miami. It's like, hey. And there's all that sort of stuff goes on, which is kind of really funny.
That sounds good.
And really interesting. So there is a genuine it's the one thing that, you know, you, people talk about the American policy towards Cuba. Civic society in Cuba works. Now, that's not to say that their government is brilliant or anything like that, but civic society on a very day-to-day level on the street works. It's really strong. But it's being pushed and pushed and pushed by American foreign policy to the point where it will break. Mm. Like, which would be terrible because, you know, it's the most coherent, cohesive society in the region. Like, you look at crime rates in Jamaica or in Haiti or in Puerto Rico even, you know, or, you know, it would be a shame to break what Cuba has, the positive things that it has. It is a place that needs change as well, but I would worry. You know, it's an interesting one in that, like, this, the crime rate is quite low there. There's no guns, there's no drugs, and it's very safe to walk around, etc. And I would worry that that society would break in some way, and what would come after that.
Okay. Now, your second last song, please.
Second last song. I love Frank Ocean. Yeah. And this one is called Super Rich Kids. Okay. I just love the beat of it. It's really mellow. And he's just such a fantastic talent. And such a mysterious kid as well.
Too many bottles of this wine we can't pronounce. Too many bowls of that green, no Lucky Charms. The maids come around too much. Parents ain't around enough. Too many joy rides in daddy's Jaguar. Too many white lies and white lines. Super rich kids with nothing but loose ends. Super rich kids with nothing but
fake. Just a couple of quick questions and then I'll let you go. So I met you, I never met you, and I'd love to meet you one day. We probably will at some point, somehow. But I always remember I was going to Rome on my earliest flight, whatever they call it, red eye.
Yeah.
Sitting down with my notebook, writing down a few things as I normally do, my journaling thing. And the only other person in the foyer doing the same as you, everybody else was on their laptop at 4 in the morning. Now, I didn't really know it was you until afterwards. So I know the face of this guy. I don't know who it was. But I find it, like I do it all the time. I have notebooks with me all the time. And it's that, like, I remember you were actually sitting kind of the other side of the aisle, and you had tons of books. So you're probably going over to shoot your Roman
series
in Italy, but your books and journey. So what is that that you read all the time?
I read all the time, and I keep a diary. So I keep a day diary. So I've got this kind of large, sort of almost a moleskin type diary, and I do a page per day. I've been doing it for years and years. It's gearing up to being one of the most boring documents in the history of Western letters. Surprisingly bitchy. I went to the shop. I was enraged by somebody. But I find it good. I remember I'd been in Galway for a few months back in my early life. Before I moved to Amsterdam, and then I moved to Dublin. And I remember trying to remember the whatever 9 months that I'd spent in Galway, what had happened, and I couldn't remember a single thing. I literally couldn't remember a single day, and I thought, actually, I should start writing things down. So from that point, I started writing things down. So I keep that as a kind of a, this is who I am, where I'm at. I then keep other diaries for ideas and bits of dialogue. I kind of do those into my phone now rather than keeping a... But the diary is written in pencil for some reason. I don't know why. If I put it down in ink, it feels so final that it would have to be a well thought out something or other. At least in pencil, you can rub it out.
Very good. So there, I need to ask you about Twitter, right? Because again, I only use Twitter for this podcast. I don't input much. I just put out stuff when the guests coming on and whatever. But I just love your Twitter, your tweets, whatever they're called, because one of my favorites is the one you seem to do quite often. You go, I'm going to the shop. Does anybody need anything? Yes. And the first time I saw it, I thought, okay, what's this? And then next thing, there's like 20 replies. Yeah, give me a bag of chips. Whatever.
You never got me butter from last night, that kind of thing.
So what's your relationship with Twitter and social media in general?
I mean, Twitter is an interesting one. There's a lot of anybody who's on Twitter will tell you there's a love-hate relationship with Twitter. I find that one thing to keep in mind with any social media is that when you're on there, you're playing a role.
Mm.
You're playing yourself or an idea of yourself, and not to take it seriously. Now, I do get into sometimes argy-bargy on there with people who are being a pain in the arse or who I sometimes want to make a political point with, blah, blah. But mostly, I'm telling really stupid jokes or really dumb observations. Or a couple of years ago, I ran this COD campaign to be president online.
I remember that.
Which was just absolutely ridiculous. And I enjoy all of that, the stupidity of it all, but also you can make points sometimes when you're being silly. And it's at the moment I find it hard to log in there. It's harder these days because, as I said, everybody's a virologist and I'm not. So it's a little bit difficult. But it's a good way to get news and all of that. And also you see some community activizations going on there. Like, as I said, Helen Riley's big help campaign that's going on now for older and marginalized people or people who are getting sick. And I think that's a really good thing. I mean, it's in all of our lives. Social media is in all of our lives. So we just got to get used to it.
I think just to finish it off, I need to give you a bit of a platform to defend your story about cats. Everybody, you got such a backlash of at first I thought it was to do with cats, the animals, and then I realized Cats, the musical turned movie. You got such a backlash on that. Tell us why you love cats so much.
Well, I'll be honest with you, I've never seen the film, but I pretended that I'd been going to see it like multiple times a day because I thought it was so special. Like, I just was reading the reviews that were coming out and people piling on to give their ultimate bad reviews, the worst thing. So I decided I'd go against all that and say it was the greatest thing that has ever happened to culture and all of that. But people were really enjoying that. But now it's available to stream. So one of these days I might actually sit down and watch Cats and see what happens. But actually people, like I was tweeting things, like I'd be going around Tesco buying me groceries and I'd be tweeting just out of the third screening of Cats today. And really the levels that it delivers to you are incredible. There's repeated viewing is what you need to do. And people were thinking I was serious about it. They were going like, really, mate? Really? Like, it's the worst thing I've ever seen. What are you doing? What are you talking about?
That's even better than the story. Look, the one thing is good, though, that there's obviously a lot of love for you. A lot of people, when I mentioned that we were going to have this chat, there's some really nice comments from everybody. It's great. No, it's great. And in fairness, as I said, my little research I did over the last few days, you do come across like a very sincere and pleasant person, which is lovely.
Try living with me.
But that's where you live on your own.
Exactly. Unbearable.
Self-isolation. You should write a book on self-isolation.
I've been doing it for years and years.
And tell me something, anything in the pipeline that we should know about or do you want to talk about?
Well, I mean, my new film, Rialto, is coming out whilst to hit the cinemas in early May, but I mean, all of that is shelved. As to whether they'll do an online streaming, it premiered in Venice last September. Okay. Which was kind of wonderful. But now, as to how it'll get out into the world, I'm not sure. So we'll just have to see what the distributor does. Everything is on hiatus, as we know. I have a play that was to be going on at the end of this year. Again, it's all on hold. And also, the impact... This is a play called Conversations After Sex, and it's about a year in the life of a young woman who's dealing with a traumatic event in her life. And she has sex with various people, and it's all about the conversations she has with relative strangers after a sexual act. It now seems like radical thing. Like, it now seems like, you touched a stranger? And so I'm just going to have to sit down and look at it again. And also, I don't know whether we'll be able to get it on this year, really, to be honest with you, what's going to happen to theaters in September, October. We don't know whether we stage it online in some way. I don't know. So that is going on. I'm also doing an adaptation of a novel by John Boyne, actually.
Okay, which one?
It's called The Heart's Invisible Furies.
Oh, yeah, love it. Yeah,
It's beautiful. It's an adaptation for television. But then, like, it is a whole history of the Irish gay experience from this man. But it does touch on the 90s. It touches on the 70s, the 80s. He does. There's an episode in New York in the 80s, which hard at the height of the AIDS pandemic.
That's right. Yeah.
And there's a whole episode in Amsterdam, which is kind of like that. I lived there, so I kind of remember or knew what he was talking about. So there's that. So I'm writing the first episode and written the Bible for it, which is your thoughts on how the rest of the adaptation will work, and that's for an American company. Mm. Everything is on hiatus, though, as to when we'll get it made. I don't know. So that I'm about to finish that, and then I'm working with another adaptation, television adaptation, which I don't think I'm allowed to say about it yet.
That's all right.
But it's working with Lenny Abrahamson again, and so there's that, and I have a film script with Lenny actually. That we'll probably make at some point. Who knows? So I am writing every day and all of that. And so hopefully something will come of it.
Brilliant. Mark, I always ask people to give me a couple of words of wisdom before they go, like a quote, anything you live, you know, get up in the morning, gets you up in the morning.
Coffee. That's all I have. Like, it's literally, you just keep on keeping on. I don't have any words of wisdom to give to anybody.
Fair enough.
Like sometimes people ask me, how do I become a writer? And I say, write. It's as simple as that. You know, how do you get up in the morning? Get up, have a banana and a bit of coffee and get going on the day. Also just, you know, there's one thing which is, and I think of it and I try to do it in my life, but I fail constantly, but it's that old Tibetan Buddhist thing, which is commit random acts of kindness. Mm. If we could all do that a bit, would be good. I mean, as I said, I fail desperately at that as well. But like at this moment, it's probably what's going to get us through.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So what are we going to leave it with? What's your last tune?
This song, I wanted something really big and happy to finish with. So this is a song called Yes by McAltman and Butler. And it's a big old song from the early 90s. And it's a belter of a tune.
Excellent.
So that'll maybe revivify people.
Well, Mark O'Halloran, thanks a million for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
I really appreciate being on, and stay safe, as they'd say, and to everybody out there, stay safe as well, and stay isolated.
Absolutely, and I'll talk to you again. Thanks a million.
All right, talk to you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.